All right, so I think this is session 9, but first we will begin with completing lecture 8. Are there any follow-up questions, confusions, queries, clarifications, any issues that anyone would like to bring to the table? Is everybody all so, I assume, well, let me put it this way. I assume anyone who isn't squared away on how they want to work on their paper, what focus or how they want to do it, anyone who is uncertain about it will have by this point checked in with me. A number of you have. It's not too late to do so. If you have questions, you can email me them. I'll be out of town Thursday through Sunday, but erratically on email, and I'll try to answer any questions about the paper as you grapple with it over the next few days. Okay, so what I wanted, yeah. Oh yes, thanks for reminding me. When you bring the hard copies in on Monday, you should bring 3 copies of the paper, 1 for me, and then 2 of them will be randomly distributed in the class. So each of you will get 2 papers from fellow students. And you are to write comments and react to them and, you know, engage them as if you were me. So, you know, you'll just pretend you're the professor and you're reading this paper and you have to say something about it to be in dialogue. Now, the spirit with which I write comments, there's really 2 sorts of things I do. There are what could be called picky comments. That's where there's a sentence that I don't understand, it's awkwardly worded, there's some, not typo, I mean, I sometimes can't resist, just because it's a habit, correcting grammar, but that's not, I'm not talking about that. But, you know, on very specific details, if there's a formulation that doesn't make sense. So I do that, and then I also engage in discussion. I treat the paper as a conversation rather than just something for me to criticize. So it's an opening gambit for a discussion of the matter. When you write your comments on your fellow students, it's more the latter, I think, that I'd like you to do. I mean, not that you can't be picky as well. Quite a few of you are proto-professors, and as part of your training for that, a certain pickiness is part of the game that you'll need to learn how to do. I have 2 reasons for wanting everyone to comment on each other's papers. There's 2 motivations. One is, I think the commenters will learn things from it, as well as the commentees. That is, I think you'll learn from reading other people's papers. One of the things it's often easier for people to see flaws and problems in other people's work than in their own. And reading other student papers of exactly the same kind of assignment is a good way of becoming more reflexive about your own work. But it's also partially to make you more sympathetic to my task, right? So you'll be a little bit more benevolent towards me with respect to this. You'll see that to read a 8 to 10 page paper and give thoughtful comments on it takes a lot of energy, it's a lot of work. And I'm going to be doing it for 25 or so papers. You'll do it for 2. So just multiply it by 10, and then I'll get sort of sympathy from the class for the work it involves. Right. Alas, I do have a commitment that's connected to the desire for all of you to learn something in the class, and one of the ways to do so is to write. The alternative would be, pop quizzes. Now, that would really destroy the ethos of this class, I think. Okay, so here's the agenda for today. I want to finish the discussion we were having last time about the classical Marxist theory of the history of capitalism's futures. I was going through the various theses that constitute the core of that theory, and I'll criticize each of them. And then I want to, in the second half, we will look at one more recent attempt at developing a theory of the trajectory of capitalism and what its inner dynamics, laws of motion are. Giovanni Arrighi's account of long cyclical or cycles of accumulation, and the character of his argument about how each of these cycles exhausts itself and why. I also thought it would be useful immediately after the break to watch a short 10-minute lecture that David Harvey gives about the current crisis, which is also extremely entertaining. It's an animated lecture, but with deep content. It's not a kind of glib characterization. And I figured out how to use that monitor attached to my laptop for us to be able to watch it. So we'll do that immediately after the break. I'm going to slightly change the form of exposition. I think it might be more useful after each of the theses for me to present the criticism rather than first lay out the overall argument and then go through the criticisms afterwards. So the first thesis on the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism, which is the one we discussed last time, that thesis is anchored in this central proposition or of Marx, referred to as the law of the falling tendency of the rate of profit. The law of the falling rate of profit is an argument which, if true, does predict that capitalism becomes more and more vulnerable over time once it matures. So once you get mature capitalism, its long-term trajectory is increasing fragility. And while there are counter tendencies and things which could slow or accelerate this, it is truly a long-term law. Marx is not really arguing the long-term future of capitalism may or may not be a falling rate of profit. It could be that the counter tendencies are more powerful than the tendencies, and therefore in the long term capitalism could stabilize at a modest but stable rate of profit. That's not the argument. Some people like to say that this is not a deterministic account, that Marx is simply indicating one of many tendencies. I think that's really not right. I think Marx is making a much stronger claim. He is predicting with an unspecified time horizon that capitalism ultimately destroys its own conditions of existence. And the core of the prediction is that its capacity to generate profits declines. And the reason that happens is that, following up with the labor theory of value, it's the costs of production that come from non-labor forms, from capital, increases faster than any compensating increase in the rate of exploitation can occur, so that you end up with a big denominator and a small numerator. What that means is that when there are other fluctuations, when there are other kinds of business cycles, they're operating on a much thinner margin, so that the crises become much more disruptive and much deeper, and recoveries become much shallower. So what's the problem with this? Yeah?
I actually just had a question. If you look at newly developed countries, when they're starting to industrialize, they often show great growth, like China, India, right, for example. But once they shift to service economies, the growth tends to be a lot shallower. Could that possibly be supportive of this thesis? You know, like if you look at, say, France, it has a very stable economy, but not a lot of growth.
Right. So the argument here is at a higher level of abstraction than any particular country. What Marx is saying is that this is true of the logic of capitalism as such. The actual world will have all sorts of uneven development. You'll have different countries at different stages of development. And if this is an argument about a trajectory that depends upon the character of the technology, then you would expect different rates of profit to occur in different parts of the world, but the tendency will be the same everywhere. So that if it's true that you get a higher rate of profit, and by the way, the rate of growth and the rate of profit aren't exactly the same thing. There are reasons you could have a high rate of growth without there being a high rate of profit. But this is meant to be an abstract characterization of the system as a whole and its long-term tendencies. But you're right that there would be a kind of secondary prediction that any given capitalism will go through this trajectory in more or less the same way. But that's not the central point of the proposition. So the first thing that's wrong with it, most fundamentally in a way, is the labor theory of value itself. This can get into quite technical matters as to why the labor theory of value isn't actually a satisfactory theory of value. It's notable that Marx never actually defends the labor theory of value. He takes it for granted. It was the way people talked about value in his day. The one place that I know of that he gives a kind of defense of the labor theory of value turns out to be an incorrect argument. So there's one place where he basically says, you have two different commodities. They're qualitatively different, shoes and bananas. They exchange at regular ratios. They must have something in common that explains why they exchange at those ratios. They must contain some metric. There must be some metric of value that explains why 200 bananas equals one pair of shoes, right? So there's got to be something that inheres in them. Then he says, what is it that they have in common that could be quantitative, that could therefore impart regular exchange ratios? And his answer is, the only thing they have in common is that they're products of labor. Now, that's the kind of syllogism. To exchange at predictable ratios, they must have something in common. The only thing they have in common is that they're products of labor. Therefore, the amount of labor bestowed upon these products is the thing that determines their exchange ratios. Now, the problem with that is it is simply not true that the only thing they have in common is that they're products of labor. They have lots of other things that have a metric, that have quantitative. For example, you could say they all require the burning of calories. Of energy. They're all the products of energy, the expenditure of energy. Human energy, fossil fuels, animal energy, whatever. You could have a calorie theory of value. Because all commodities, all things that exchange, took a certain number of calories of expended energy to transform nature into those things. The bananas had to be picked, they had to be packed, they had to be shipped. All of those involve the expenditure of energy, human and non-human. So that's one example. But you could also say every single thing that you exchange in a market is the product of iron, because there's nothing that's produced in which iron doesn't figure directly or indirectly. If they're transported, they're surely transported in vehicles that have some iron in them. And you could talk about the amount of iron that's expended for the production of all of the things that are produced. So you could have an iron theory of value. Someone has proposed a corn theory of value, a calorie theory of value. You can have a theory of value that taps into anything, any input that's an input for all outputs. And it's simply not true that labor is the only input for all outputs. And therefore, if that's the only argument for why labor is the input that generates new value and imparts value to products, that's not a justified argument, because it simply isn't true. What some economists have proposed is that the key issue here is that there's some kind of scarce input. It's the scarcity of input. It's inputs that, so for example, air, oxygen is an input into all outputs. But oxygen is freely available and it isn't scarce in general. So that an oxygen theory of value wouldn't work, because you don't have to make choices about allocating oxygen to one purpose or another. It's completely freely available. So really what you have is a scarcity theory of value. If there was no scarcity of any input, that is, if it was all like oxygen, then there would be no value to the products. It's that all production takes the form of allocating resources, and that the best theory of value would be one that is, in a sense, a composite vector of all the scarce inputs, not just one, not just labor. This is a particular way of approaching value that's associated with the Italian economist Sraffa, S-R-A-F-F-A. And in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a flurry of Marxian work around the Sraffian approach to the theory of value. These are things that we don't need to really discuss. I think the main issue here is that the foundation for the labor theory of value depends upon labor being the numeraire, the measure of value, and there just is no justification for that argument. It doesn't have any foundation. Now, there are other reasons why you might want to treat labor as a measure of value. One is that we care about people. We don't care about iron. We don't care about corn. We care about the well-being of people. And the fact that we're measuring commodities by the amount of human life, energy, and effort that's put into it is a good normative reason for having a labor theory of value, but not an explanatory reason. Therefore, the labor theory of value could be relevant for a concept of exploitation because it tells us how much of the labor effort of the people who produce things is being returned to them in the form of their consumption and how much is being taken away. That's a nice measure of extraction of labor effort. But that doesn't mean that it explains the exchange of commodities, nor that you can use it to predict the rate of profit. Yeah. There are lots of crises in which profits decline cyclically. In fact, indeed, in all crises, in the downturn, profits decline. So the question, the labor theory of value and the falling rate of profit is not about cycles. It's about long-term trends. Why the rate of profit should not only be lower in mature economies than in developing economies, but why it should continue to decline. So there are good reasons why profits in a newly industrializing economy with new capitalism, why profits should be very high in such economic situations, and why they will decline as the economy matures, but not why it should continue to decline. And the mechanisms just aren't bound up with the labor theory of value. The mechanisms are to be explained by other factors. Just one other thing about the labor theory of value, even if we accept the labor theory of value, why in the end it shouldn't be seen as robustly predicting a falling tendency of the rate of profit, is that the idea that capital intensity continues indefinitely to increase is also not really true. Capital intensity has been falling steadily in advanced economies, not increasing. The simplest example is the hand calculator. You know, your iPods with its calculator on it. When I was a undergraduate, there were no electronic calculators. Actually, they were just being introduced in the mid '60s. But you know, in the '50s, there weren't. There were these big Monroe mechanical calculators with levers and stuff. Now those things required huge amounts of labor to produce. They were big, bulky, mechanical devices for doing calculations. Small hand calculators, digital calculators now are basically free. You know, they cost for a few dollars you can get a hand calculator. They basically embody virtually no labor, right? And they basically do the same thing that they actually do a bit more, but it basically still takes one person. If you want to add up a bunch of numbers, it takes one person to enter the numbers and hit equals. And the productivity of the person doing it isn't that different from doing it with the old mechanical calculators for simple addition stuff. But the capital intensity is vastly lower. The fact is that once new machines replace old machines, that is, once you've moved from replacing hand tools with machines, and you then subsequent technological change replaces new machines with old machines, it's not at all obvious that the costs of the physical capital in production increase over time. They can go down, and so the numerator can decline, because the machines are themselves being produced much more efficiently than they were in the past. So the core of the rising or of the falling rate of profit was what Marx called the rising organic composition of capital, which basically had to do with the ratio between the new living labor in production and the old embodied dead labor. Since only living labor produces new value, and that's what generates the rate of profit. But even if you accept all of that about the labor theory of value, it is not the case that the amount of embodied dead labor in a production process is constantly increasing. One of the reasons why there are more small producers today in certain sectors, and I mean in manufacturing, I'm not talking about service sectors, is that the capital requirements have gone down. The capital requirements to become a printing shop, for example, are orders of magnitude cheaper now than they were 30 years ago. It's possible for a group of people who want to set up a workers' cooperative to be printers to do it now because of digital printing, which is incredibly cheap compared to offset, you know, typesetting printing of the past. There are other reasons why there may be barriers to them doing so, which have to do with the way markets are being organized, but not because of capital intensity. That's no longer a barrier for lots of systems of production. So the first thesis then, the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism as a economic law is problematic. Now, in response to that, there have been proposals for other reasons besides the reasons that Marx laid out for why capitalism in the end is doomed, why it has inherent contradictions of the sort that destroy its conditions of possibility. The most notable recent candidate for that is ecological. You know, if capitalism is destroying the environment, and especially via the mechanisms of global warming, then it destroys its conditions of existence. I'm pretty skeptical of that argument. I'm not skeptical of the argument that capitalism is bad for the environment, but I'm skeptical of the argument that by virtue of that, it destroys its own conditions of profitability. There's a hell of a lot of money to be made out of global warming. Global warming can function with respect to capitalism like World War II did. You know, it can be an enormously profitable enterprise. Of course, there'll be huge amounts of human suffering, but capitalism has never stumbled over the fact that it wreaks havoc with people's lives. That's perfectly compatible with a robust capitalism. The question is whether environmental degradation actually hurts the accumulation process, whether it actually undercuts profitability. Global warming is going to require huge amounts of projects of mitigation, of counter moves to deal with the ramifications of global warming. Somebody's going to have to build the seawalls. Someone's going to have to engage in the new energy projects that will counter the effects of global warming and so on. The likely producers of these things are capitalist firms under contract by the state. And that will be just like the military-industrial complex was a huge engine of accumulation during the Cold War, the environmental-industrial complex could be a huge engine of accumulation in the decades to come in the 21st century. The Dutch government has a 100-year plan for raising the seawalls in the North Sea. The Dutch have figured out how to live below sea level for a long time. So we know that coastal areas can thrive below sea level. They just can't thrive below sea level without doing something, and the Dutch have these fantastic seawalls that they've figured out how to build that are robust. They withstand tremendous storms. They're just not high enough to deal with the melting of the Greenland ice cap. So the Dutch have this plan to do it. The sea is going to rise. Even the most catastrophic views have it rising, you know, a few inches a year. It's not going to rise meters per year. There's going to be plenty of time to monitor the rising sea levels and build the bigger seawalls. The biggest problem the Dutch have, apparently, is not that they'll be inundated from the North Sea, but that the Rhine River will back up because of the rising sea levels. And they'll be inundated from Germany as a huge inland sea in Germany is created. The only solution to that is to dam the Rhine River and pump the water from the Rhine River over the dam so that the Rhine River doesn't back up. Now, that's a gigantic project. Hundreds of billions of dollars will have to be spent to create the aqueducts to have the Rhine River flow from, I don't know how far inland, maybe 20 or 30 kilometers, whatever, 50 kilometers. So you'll have to basically raise the Rhine River to have it go over this seawall that's going to be built. But that's a big engineering project. Human beings are capable of doing that. They can mobilize the resources. And the question is, can that be done under capitalist conditions? It certainly can't be done under free market conditions, but it can be done by having contracts given to private capitalist firms who will hire labor, exploit them, and make a bundle off of it, just like aircraft carriers are built by hiring workers and contracting with private capitalist firms. So I don't think the environmental crisis, however horrible and devastating it is itself a threat to capitalism. Now, of course, if it's a threat to the planet, if life on Earth ceases, that destroys capitalism. Right, so I'm not making the proposition that capitalism will thrive in the absence of people. What? It's pretty resilient. Yeah, we'll get all those robots going and let us keep building the dams over the Rhine River even after there's no people to. So, the most catastrophic ones do show the non-sustainability of capitalism, but not by anything specific to capitalism is the point. All right, that's basically the first thesis. If I keep going at this pace, we certainly won't get to the second argument is the intensification of anti-capitalist class struggles. So let's assume for the moment that there is a long-term non-sustainability of capitalism, or at least there's a slightly weaker version, that capitalism does become more rather than less vulnerable over time. So let's just assume that's true for the moment, that the resilience of capitalism is undermined by capitalist development. The second thesis is called the intensification of anti-capitalist class struggle thesis. The dynamics of capitalist development systematically tend, first, to increase the proportion of the population, the working class, whose interests are pervasively harmed by capitalism, and at the same time, second, to increase the capacity of the working class to challenge capitalism. The result is an intensification of class struggle directed against capitalism itself. So this is the second core of Marx's argument. As capitalism develops, one of the things it does is destroys pre-capitalist relations of production, destroys the petty bourgeoisie and small businesses, and increasingly throws people into the conditions of what Marx called the proletariat, that is, wage laborers who, in order to live, have to sell their labor power. A greater and greater proportion of the population is in that condition. That part of the class structure is the part that is most directly harmed by capitalism itself. It does this while at the same time increasing their capacity for struggle. In Marx's view, it did so by bringing them together into large concentrations of labor. So instead of working in dispersed workshops, they worked in ever-increasing concentrations, which made their collective organization easier. Their class capacity is increased by the creation of factories instead of cottage industries in the 19th century, for example. These two movements, the expansion of the size of the working class as a proportion of the population, and its organization into higher concentrations of interdependency, meant that their capacity for struggle increased over time. Thus, the intensity of class struggle thesis. We'll be discussing those arguments more directly when we get to the section on class formation, which will be in a couple of weeks. But let me just give the shortest of versions of the problems. First of all, it's not the case that the size of the working class continuously increases over time. Even if one decides that every single wage earner is going to be considered in the working class. Now, most people are hesitant to do that. Managers don't really seem like working class in the same sense that Marx meant. There's a large number of positions in the economic structure that are paid wages, earn a salary, but don't seem to be in that social relationship that defines their interests as fully antagonistic to capitalism, that they have what I call contradictory class locations. So one reason why the class structure doesn't become as polarized as Marx thought is because of a growth of these contradictory class locations. But it turns out that there's actually been a growth of self-employment over time as well. Some of this is disguised wage labor. Stephen is studying self-employed truckers who are really in a hot and an incredibly subordinated and exploited position with respect to capital, in spite of them being technically self-employed. But it's actually the case that genuine self-employment has increased because the capital intensity to be self-employed in various kinds of service sector occupations is sufficiently low that it's viable for people to be independent contractors, and to be independent contractors in a way that isn't really just disguised employment. It really is a different kind of relationship. So the class structure has actually become much more complicated rather than less complicated. And for a whole variety of reasons, the capacity for struggle doesn't seem to have any general tendency to increase over time. I wouldn't go to the opposite extreme and say that there's some law of disorganization, that as capitalism develops, it becomes inherently harder to organize. I think it's just a contingent. I don't think there's any general tendency. So the intensification of anti-capitalist class struggle thesis seems to me on weak foundations. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, so maybe it's true that capitalism doesn't concentrate class anti-capitalism class struggle, but would you say that it does increase the amount of people who would benefit from a change in the system? That enough people are taken advantage of or are losing in a capitalist right. system that it would be to the advantage of the majority of people and an ever-growing majority over time to change the system?
I do think that transcending capitalism is in the interest of a large majority of people. That is, their lives would go better under an alternative. Whether that's steadily increasing or becoming more and more internally ambiguous is not so clear to me. That is, what happens is you simultaneously people may have lots to gain from an alternative and have a bigger stake in the present system. Both things can happen at the same time. A higher proportion of the population today, for example, have part of their income come in the form of returns to capital than was true 50 years ago. More people have stock portfolios today than they did 50 years ago. a higher proportion of the population. We have this irony in the United States that that stock ownership is both increasingly concentrated, the percentage of stocks owned by the top 1% goes up, and the percentage of people who own stock goes up. Both are true. There's both more diffusion and more concentration. And that creates a lot of complexity on these issues, right, in terms of where it goes. There's the added problem, of course, which is part of the next thesis, that people might be better off in an alternative, but much worse off if we move toward the alternative, because there are costs of getting there. And the cost of getting there may be so big that even if being there, being in an alternative, would make life go better, life would be so much worse in the process of moving there that it's not worth the journey. That's a very big issue. That's a huge problem. That's one of the things we'll be discussing when we talk about both at the end of the semester around logics of social transformation and in the discussion of class formation when we talk about this very interesting concept of class compromise, why class compromise makes sense. That is, working out the best deal you can in capitalism as opposed to struggling against capitalism can actually be the best option for people. And not because of false consciousness, not because they don't understand. They may also have false consciousness, but it may not be because of false consciousness. It may be because the costs of the transition just are not worth it given the kind of deal you can strike in the world in which you live. Okay. Thesis 3, the revolutionary transformation thesis. Since capitalism becomes increasingly precarious as an economic system, that's the first thesis, it becomes more and more vulnerable, while the principal class arrayed against capitalism becomes increasingly large and capable of challenging capitalism, thesis 2. So you got these two movements going on, increasing capacity to fight, decreasing ability to resist. And eventually these two trends, so to speak, cross. And the capacity to challenge capitalism becomes very strong just as capitalism is becoming more and more fragile. Eventually, those two trends reach a tipping point when socialism, defined as a society in which the system of production is collectively owned and controlled through egalitarian democratic institutions, is its most likely successor. Since the collectively owned working class will be in the best position to ensure, I shifted to the fourth thesis. Okay, back to thesis 3, sorry about that. Thesis 1 was the system becomes more precarious. Thesis 2, the class capable of challenging capitalism becomes stronger. Because of those two things, eventually the social forces opposing capitalism will be sufficiently strong and capitalism sufficiently weak that the institutions designed to protect capitalism will no longer be able to prevent it being overthrown. Now that last bit is really important. Remember, in classical historical materialism, the base superstructure argument is that there's a set of institutions created, the state being the crucial one, but ideology also being important, whose purpose is to stabilize the base, to prevent it from being transformed. In the absence of a superstructure, then capitalism would have been transformed a long time ago. In the absence of protective mechanisms that keep it in place, the challenges of workers and others against capitalist institutions would have, the argument goes, transformed capitalism long before it became feeble as an economic system. It would have been transformed because the interests of actors would have been sufficient to generate the mobilization. What the superstructure does is make it very hard to transform these economic relations. Superstructures protect economic relations. They make it hard to transform them. But eventually, the task imposed on the superstructure just becomes too big. Capitalism is such a weak system, and workers and their collective organization sufficiently strong that the superstructure cannot protect it. Now, one has to ask, why would that be so? Basically, I think the argument depends upon elements of the superstructure, the people in the superstructure. There's actual human beings that are, after all, executing these relations. They're not being done by automatons. That they see that an alternative would be better for them as well. Basically, the superstructure fractures; it breaks apart. There's all sorts of ways this can happen, but it could happen conceivably democratically. It could happen through other means. But basically, the idea is that the integrity of the superstructure doesn't hold together. It cannot be unified because the resources needed to fund the superstructure become difficult to obtain because of capitalism's weakness. And there's large defections from both the repressive apparatus and the ideological apparatus, so that machinery of support basically disintegrates in the face of these challenges. And that's the revolutionary transformation thesis. Decline, increasing fragility of capitalism, increasing strength of opposition, and declining capacity of the superstructures to block the successful transition. This, again, I think in Marx's own work and in classical Marxism is meant to be a real prediction. It's not meant to be, well, this could happen possibly. It's meant to be a real long-term prediction about the fate. The next thesis, however, has a more tentative character. See, thesis 3 just announces the destruction of capitalism. Right? It's a revolutionary destruction of capitalism. It's overthrown. What comes in the aftermath of capitalism? Well, Marx himself had a, I think it was Marx, but it may be someone else. I think the socialism or barbarism quip originally came from Marx. Rosa Luxemburg also, I think, is associated with that expression. Marx didn't literally say that the only possible alternative that emerges in the aftermath of capitalism is socialism. There was this vague reference to barbarism being the alternative. And it is possible that the collective organization of workers, once it overthrows capitalism, could itself be seized by social forces interested in building something other than socialism. And the alternative could be, quote, barbarism, that is, some other form of coercive extraction that would recreate class relations in some new form. That isn't the main line of argument, however. The main line of argument is that given that the interests of workers are so much in line with a democratic, egalitarian organization of economic institutions, and given that they were powerful enough to overthrow capitalism, so given that the theory of the overthrow of capitalism is that it's the collectively organized and solidaristic working class that will do it, they are the agents that are going to do this overthrow, and given what their interests are in building an alternative, that the alternative that they will build will be a collectively organized, democratically run economic system. Because this is the system which would be most in the interests of workers. The theory behind that is basically where there's a will, there's a way. You know, I think at its core, the argument is that this is driven by the ideological commitments and the willingness to experiment and the collective capacity to stay the course of a strongly organized class movement. One way of thinking about this, and when this is a controversial characterization, is that Marx's theory of the decline and overthrow of capitalism is deterministic, but his theory of the building of the alternative is voluntaristic. That is, the classic slogan from Marx, people make history, but not just as they choose. One can perhaps say that the not just as they choose part describes the demise of capitalism, but the people make history part describes the building of socialism. That is, once capitalism is destroyed, then people do make history just as they choose. That is, where there's a will, there's a way. Finally, there's the utopian thesis, the last one, the communism destination thesis, which is that the dynamics of socialist development gradually leads to a strengthening of community solidarity and a progressive erosion of material inequalities, so that eventually classes and the state will wither away, resulting in the emergence of a communist society organized around the distributional principle, to each according to need, from each according to ability. It's a society within which there may be administration of various sorts, but no state. That is, no coercive apparatus specialized in reproducing the relations. There needs be no superstructure in such a society, because there are no forces in play to destroy the existing relations of production. The reason you need a state and superstructure in class societies is that in the absence of a state and superstructure, the class relations will explode. You don't need, again, this is a functional argument, you don't need a superstructure in a communist society, because there are no forces in play that would want to overthrow it. All that you need is some kind of coordinating mechanism, because there's complexity, there's needs for various kinds of coordination. But a coordinating structure need not have a repressive apparatus attached to it. That, I think, is the utopian moment in the Marxian idea. But it follows directly from the logic of the whole argument. That is, the whole logic for why you need a superstructure in the prior phases suggests that once classes are no longer present, you don't need a superstructure. Since it's only the class antagonisms which explains why a stabilization of those relations of production is needed, why they aren't self-reproducing. In a communist society, the notion would be that the relations of production become self-reproducing relations, not requiring coercive apparatuses. In this respect, it's like in hunting and gathering societies. Hunting and gathering societies didn't have specialized repressive apparatuses either. They were self-reproducing societies. The socialization of people into the norms of cooperation and reciprocity at the micro level in those societies was sufficient to reproduce the relations of production, namely the forms of cooperation in those societies, without specialized repressive apparatuses. And that argument then applies in the post-class social structure as well. Well, that's the classical Marxist theory of the trajectory of history. We've discussed, I've already laid out, you know, en route many of the weaknesses around several of the theses. The one, I guess, I don't think I need to go through more of the critical comments about that now, that they're also laid out in the chapter. So why don't we just, let's put this on the table for further discussion. First of all, is the basic argument, is the setup of this argument, these five theses, is that clear to everyone? And given that it's clear, yeah, Paula.
I guess it's not really clear to me what socialism looks like. Because it still has the superstructure.
So in Marx's and in the Marxian classical view, socialism still has a superstructure. Another term for socialism is a term which doesn't sound well today for historical reasons, the dictatorship of the proletariat. The expression dictatorship in that context simply means that the proletariat is dictating the basic structure of the society. So it should be the dictatingship of the proletariat, as it were. There was no idea that the dictatorship of the proletariat wouldn't be a profoundly democratic form of regime. It was not seen as an authoritarian top-down regime. It was just all that dictatorship meant was that there were laws in place and constitutional provisions which protected a new set of relations of production which were in the interests of the working class. Now, the argument for why you needed a state and superstructure and ideological machinery and all this in socialism was that those social relations would not be self-reproducing. They would have strong tendencies to disintegrate, to be transformed in the absence of a state and other mechanisms to keep them in place. One reason for that was the existence of capitalist forms during an extended transition period. So socialism sometimes was described as the transition between capitalism and communism. So communism is the alternative to capitalism, but then there's this long transitional period where certain kinds of capitalist institutions might still exist. There'll still be various, there might even be private capitalist firms in various ways. And all of this would be a corrosive process to the new relations unless there was a set of institutions in place to prevent the corrosion so that a state or superstructure was needed for that purpose. But even if one doesn't have that way of thinking about it, that is this communism destination idea, I think any plausible transcendence of capitalism would require, you know, a fairly strong state capacity with repressive abilities, that is the ability to block challenges of a certain sort. That doesn't mean, again, that it has to have anything like a police state. It doesn't mean it wouldn't have the rule of law. It doesn't mean that the achievements of capitalist society in terms of individual rights and liberties wouldn't be preserved and extended. I see a socialist state as building on the accomplishments of a capitalist state and not abandoning them. So I don't see due process and the rule of law being bourgeois institutions that should be abandoned under alternative class relations. Yeah?
I have a question. This might seem ridiculous, but if capitalism was transcended by socialism, given like human nature, that some people, you know, have the desire to dominate others or have more things than other people, is it possible that you could get another capitalist society, like from a socialist society? Like people living in a socialist society being like, oh, well, if I, you know, cheat and do this, I could still have more than that. And you just like start the whole cycle over.
Well, this is, of course, one of the reasons why you do need a state to block certain kinds of strategies of people. So even in capitalism, there are laws which prevent capitalists from acting in certain ways, even though those ways would be profitable. In many developed capitalist countries, for example, sweatshops are not allowed. In ours, in the U.S., they are, but in Sweden and Denmark, they're not allowed. You're not allowed to have vulnerable workers who you promise to pay a certain amount and then you pay them less. So there's lots of things that people would like to do because they're self-interested that get blocked in a capitalist society. In a socialist society, there would also be lots of things that people might want to do that get blocked. Now, they might still engage in illegal activities, but the extent to which that is corrosive of socialism or just a problem that has to be dealt with would be an issue. There is the problem, I think, if socialist economies turned out to be inherently much less productive than capitalist ones, that is, if any variety of socialism, not just the kinds we've seen attempted historically, but any variety, even with strong democratic institutions and strong protections of individual autonomy and the like, if it nevertheless would turn out to be, in spite of everyone's best hopes, much less productive than the comparable capitalism, capitalism with the comparable technologies, then under democratic conditions, people might actually opt to go back to capitalism. Right? So I don't think it should be treated as axiomatic. It's not axiomatic that a socialist alternative to capitalism would be one that people would prefer. What's axiomatic is they would prefer it if it behaves and functions the way I think it would, but it's not axiomatic that it will function and behave the way I think it will. That's a complicated matter because there are unintended consequences and perverse effects of any institutional arrangement. And it's not something that you can just take for granted, that just because a deeper democratic control of production gives people more control over their lives, that they wouldn't decide under those conditions that actually, given all the trade-offs, they'd rather have somebody else own the means of production and work for them. Right? It could play out that way. Part of the task of, this is jumping to the head, you know, the end of the semester, of the real utopia kind of view of socialism, part of the task is to think about all the ways in which and all the problems you have to contend with in order for an alternative to capitalism to actually make the lives of people better rather than just in an idealized way make the lives of people better. Because if it's to be stable under democratic conditions, it has to actually, as they say, deliver the goods. Now, I don't mean that means it has to be a high consumerist society. My own view is that one of the problems with capitalism is that it turns its productivity into consumerism rather than turns its productivity into quality of life. But still, if it actually turns out to be heavily burdened with all sorts of inefficiencies that make it less productive altogether so that people have to work harder for less in a socialist economy, then probably if it was democratic, people would opt out of it. But those are issues that we'll be puzzling about at the end of the semester. Other questions about these theses and their weaknesses? All right, I think we should, let's take a break. I will set up the video so that we can see the David Harvey program. Okay, well, you can see how that ties into the Righi argument. Harvey, like Giovanni Arrighi, sees the specific dynamics of finance as being central to the crisis, the process through which crises are created. The difference is Harvey here is only focusing on this particular crisis in which we're located now. He's trying to explain why this crisis is generated by the excesses of finance. What Arrighi is trying to do is develop a general argument for the long history of capitalism about how the specific role of finance is central to explaining the overall character of the trajectory through what he calls systemic cycles of accumulation, each of which has a financialization phase, which eventually leads to an economic crisis through which a new cycle gets generated. In Arrighi's argument, this is embedded in a particular strand of Marxian thinking called world systems theory. Arrighi was a close colleague of Emanuel Wallerstein. Arrighi, by the way, just so you know, he died 2 years ago. He was a professor at Johns Hopkins, died of brain cancer, well, I guess lung cancer that metastasized 2 years ago. The last thing he really wrote was the appendix, uh, the the epilogue to a long 20th century, bringing it up to date. He has another book after a long 20th century, but before the epilogue, called Adam Smith in Beijing, which is basically about the nature of Chinese capitalism. So Arrighi's idea is to combine aspects of world systems theory, which attempts to understand capitalism as a global system right from the start, unlike globalization theory, which sees the global character of capitalism as something that's distinctive about it now, but as something relatively new. World systems theory sees the modern world system as emerging more or less in the 16th and 17th centuries, and then evolving and changing its character over time. But capitalism was already a global system back when it first really took hold. Arrighi's working in that tradition, but gives much more attention to the class dynamics of the capitalist economy and to this particular, and in particular to this problem of the character of capital accumulation and its cycles of development over time. What I'd like to do is just briefly sketch, go through the steps of his argument. Now, originally, I say this, of course, in each section of the course. Originally, we had, I think, three sessions on alternative long view historical trajectories, and in particular, there was a lecture that revolved around some early work that I did on a similar theme, which I decided to cut out because I think Arrighi's is probably more relevant to the present situation. So this should not be taken as defining a definitive, as my definitive view as to how you should think about the long-term trajectory of capitalism. But rather, I'm just using it as an example of one way of developing a systemic logic for a long-term trajectory. So the starting point of Arrighi's analysis is similar to what Harvey says, that is, that we should think of capitalist accumulation as involving this triplet. This is a kind of classical Marxian formula, MCM prime. M stands for money, C stands for commodities, and M prime means more money. So the fundamental process of capital accumulation begins with capitalists having control over a certain quantity of capital, called M, a certain amount of money, which they choose to invest in one way or another. Investing means they use that money to buy something. They can buy machines and land and factories and hire workers. That's one way they could use their M. Or they could buy goods in one place, pay for shipping, and sell it in another place. Simple merchant capitalism, where you buy in one place and sell in another, I think should still be regarded as a kind of production process. This isn't the typical way that it's treated, but transporting goods from the Spice Islands to Europe is a transformation of those goods. You know, pepper on a tree in the Spice Islands is not the same as pepper on a table in the Netherlands. And the difference is it's located in a different space and it requires a huge expenditure of energy and coordination and a labor process with sailors and packers and all that to get it from the Spice Islands to Europe. So I wouldn't draw as sharp a contrast between merchant capital and industrial capitalism, in the sense that the latter involves actual producing things and the former doesn't. Transportation around the world is an important form of producing the actual consumable commodity. But in any case, you start with M. You invest it in some kind of some set of commodities and some sort of process. But they only, capitalists will only do so in the belief that at the end of the process they're going to end up with more money than they began with. That's the whole point of it. If you end up with perpetually with the same amount of money, it's a lot less trouble to just hoard the money and spend it, to treat the money as a source of consumption. There's no point in investing it unless you expect to make more than you started with. The purpose of investment, therefore, is not actually production. It's the increase in the size of the capital you have. And typically this is described as the purpose of investment is accumulation. Now remember, we had this discussion as to whether or not the capitalist is actually forced in any way to devote part of that increment in money to expanded production, or whether the capitalist could start with M, end up with M prime, eat the prime, have the original M back, and then just repeat endlessly that same process. Remember that discussion? Accumulation means that you expand the process over time. Simply making profits doesn't establish accumulation. It just establishes profit making. And we had the discussion about why there are reasons to believe that in order for the capitalist to continue indefinitely living off the capital, in many circumstances, they're actually forced to accumulate, not just invest to get a return which they consume. But they're actually forced to accumulate. And the reasons for that had to do with the fact that there are economies of scale, which means that if they don't accumulate, they will eventually be unable to sell the products they have acquired because their costs of production will be higher than others. Competition, therefore, will force individual capitalists to increase in scale because that's important for them to remain competitive. And that's what actually makes this an accumulation process, not just a profit-making process. All right, so the basic structure of the setup, therefore, is that you start with money, you invest it in commodities, and you end up with more money. The way Arrighi characterizes this process is by saying that having M means flexibility. These are resources that can be flexibly deployed in whatever way is most profitable. Having C means rigidity. It means you've committed your M to some project. Funds are locked up in some purpose, which narrow down your options. M is called liquidity in the contemporary discussions. It means you have the ability to do whatever you want with it. Once you commit it to a project, the Merchant of Venice committing the M to the three ships that are bringing back commodities, your options are narrow. M prime means expanded flexibility and new opportunities. So here's then the general argument. The basic idea of Arrighi's analysis is that MCM prime doesn't only represent the logic of individual capitalist rationality, it also represents a certain logic of the development of the system. Capitalism, in his view, has, since its very inception, gone through a series of cycles which have two phases or components corresponding to this MCM prime formula. First, there's a cycle of material expansion. This is the MC phase. This is a phase in which money capital sets in motion ever-increasing amounts of commodity capital. So there's an MC phase of capitalist development within each of these systemic cycles of accumulation, an MC phase in which the main way that capitalists are making money is by locking it up in some kind of commodity form. it can be in trade or it can be in factories or whatever, that will vary historically. But the main way that wealth is being acquired is by turning money into commodities. Then there's a cycle of financial expansion. This is the CM prime phase, where capital sets itself free from productive activities, and most of the dynamic of accumulation involves strictly financial instruments, where capitalists make their money primarily through the manipulation of money rather than by locking their money up in commodities. In his account, there have been a series of this process also has what he calls a spatio-temporal character. There have been four such systemic cycles of accumulation in the history of capitalism in Arrighi's analysis. Each of them is characterized by an initial phase of material expansion, followed by a phase of financial expansion. He calls these the Genoese phase from the 15th to the 17th century, the Genoese cycle, the Dutch cycle from the 16th through most of the 18th century, the British cycle from the latter half of the 18th century to the early 20th, and the U.S. cycle from the late 19th century until the present. Those are his four phases. Each of these cycles of accumulation in Arrighi's account occurs on a larger scale. That is, Genoa is a city, the Dutch are a small republic, the British phase is an island country, and the United States is a continental country. And each of them have been compressed in time. The length of each of these phases so far has gotten, the temporal structure has gotten condensed. The Genoese was the longest, then the Dutch, then the British, and now the American. The question then is, why do you get cycles? Why does the history of capitalist development have this form, where you begin with a period of material expansion, which then triggers a process of financial expansion? So here's the basic way the Arrighi tells the story. Under the protection of some hegemonic power, so there's an important role for the state in his argument, some power that's capable of protecting particular capitalist interests. Capitalists in the leading economic center engage in the first type of accumulation, the MC accumulation. This could be trade or production. In the Genoese case, it was certainly trade. By the British case, production was a central part of it. The important part is that investment in the real economy is the result, and this has the consequence of stimulating sustained expansion of material production. The MC phase, protected by some hegemonic power, stimulates material production. This creates rapidly expanding opportunities for other capitalists to copy the initiatives of capitalists of the leading power, and over time the intensity of competition increases. So whereas initially under the protection of the hegemonic power, the leading capitalists were able to make high levels of profits through material investment, intensification of competition over time erodes these profit opportunities. So this is the key dynamic in play. The hegemonic power creates an environment within which very profitable material investments can be achieved. That opens up a space for other capitalists to copy and compete and enter the same arena. Competition intensifies, and the intensification of competition erodes these profit opportunities. If you look at the United States cycle, after the Second World War, with the devastation of the economies of Europe and Japan, under the protection of the American hegemonic power, the possibilities for profit-making through material expansion by American capital were huge. Because of our economic dominance and because of the protection of the American hegemonic world order. In time, however, competition increased. General Motors and Ford eventually encountered competition from both Volkswagen and Toyota. The intensity of competition increases in the course of the post-war boom. In Arrighi's view, it's the increasing intensity of competition which erodes the profitability of material expansion. Now, other things may come into play as well. That is, Harvey makes the argument that in that particular expansion, the increasing strength of labor eroded the profitability of capitalist production in the United States. His characterization was that the problem in the 70s, which was this period of stagnation, was that labor had been so successful in raising wages that it had put a squeeze on the profits of capitalists, which led to the smashing of labor in order to unleash higher rates of exploitation and more profitability. Arrighi's argument is that those things are secondary. The real thing that determines the profitability of material investment is the intensity of competition. That can be exacerbated if the intensity of competition occurs from lower wage economies. You know, there's all sorts of specificities to how this would work. But intensity of competition would be corrosive of capitalist profits, even if there weren't those additional factors. When that intensity of competition reaches a certain point, capitalists want to escape that pressure by finding other ways of accelerating their rates of profit that don't depend upon their competitive advantages within material production. All of this is occurring in the context of geopolitical competition. And in Arrighi's analysis, militarism is really crucial for this process. As the rates of profits decline, geopolitical competition between states increases. This provides opportunities for capitalists to shift their investments from commodity capital to financial instruments, especially government debt. Government debt assures capital of high rates of return and low risk, since it is backed by the coercive taxation capacity of states. In effect, taxation provides a way of pumping surplus out of the population to support the investments, the interest payments to financial capital. For Arrighi, the key mechanism of financialization is government debt. And historically, really until I think the second half of the 20th century, that was probably right. That is, the government debt was probably the main way in which purely financial instruments were able to generate rates of return to capital. Consumer debt and housing debt are relatively newer phenomena on a large scale. And even today, government debt obviously has played a huge role in the current financial situation, not just consumer debt. But Harvey emphasizes in his account the invention of these new devices for extracting surplus in creating consumer debt. Now, debt, you see, has a different, let's focus on government debt. Government debt is a very different mechanism by which you begin with M and you end with M prime. What you do is you begin with M, you lend it to the government. The government extracts surplus from the population in the form of taxation and gives part of that surplus back to the lenders of the M. So the M prime is not the result of locking your money up with some commodity production process. Your M prime is the result of locking your money up with a coercive capacity of the state to extract taxes to pay you a return on your investment. this shift to financial assets as the principal outlet for investment also tends to encourage speculative investments in various and other sorts, which generates bubbles. So a characteristic feature of this second phase of each systemic cycle of accumulation is increasing speculative forms of financial investment, where you are speculating on the increase in the price of some asset as a way of getting a return on your investment rather than the productivity of that asset. And it's 5 to 12. I think I was hoping to, of course, wrap up our trajectory of capitalism story before beginning the class analysis section next week. I think it's still best to stop now. There's only a little bit left of Arrighi's story to tell, and I'll finish this up on Monday, and then we'll begin the next section of the course.